This is Dave Crowder, and I'm interviewing a Dave today, and this is David Pignolosa, and I'm at his house now. It's July the 23rd. I guess the main part of this interview, David, is about, you know, the two books that you've written, Volume 1 and Volume 2. The first one, Calabi Matrix, and the second one, Quinto. What do you call it again?
Rumba Quinto.
Rumba Quinto. So we're about ready for the annual Humboldt drum dance and song camp. And David has been my teacher several years. Probably, actually, I think I've had a class of his every single year I've been here. I think this is my fifth year this year. So I'm very happy, very psyched, you know, and I'm really glad that you okayed this and you decided to go ahead and, you know, do this podcast. So I'm honored, and I'm sure that everybody who's listening to this podcast has some form of interest in what you've been doing, probably your book. You know, I bet a bunch of people have, if not looked at it, you know, referred to your book in some way. So let's start with I think first question to ask you is, how did you first get into Afro-Cuban music?
Well, I always felt an affinity for conga drums. I didn't know what they were, really. I think maybe I thought they were Mexican drums or an African American drum because of the bands that I saw them played in. I remember when I was 13 years old walking across Sproul Plaza at UC Berkeley and hearing the drummers there play, and I just livened up my step, and I always felt like I could do it. I couldn't, but I always felt like, wow, it really communicated to me. I was 21 years old and I walked into a percussion class at Santa Rosa Junior College, and I said, I want to learn percussion. And the dean of music said, you're 15 years too late.
Whoa.
But I was determined to learn percussion. I've been playing flute since I was in fourth grade, but I wasn't really being satisfied musically the way I wanted to be. I saw a notice up on the bulletin board at college. Kim Atkinson was giving conga lessons, and he was my first teacher, and that started my journey as a student.
So that was when you were 21, mm-hmm. and how old are you now?
I'm 54 now.
Okay, so that's like over 30 years, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. So did you grow up banging on trash can lids
a little bit, yeah. When I was little, I used to pull all the pots and pans out of my mom's, like when I was two.
Okay.
And beating on them in the kitchen, getting just so...
Yeah, pretend you're the big trap set player.
I don't even know if I had a concept of what a drummer was. I think I just liked it a lot. So,
yeah. So it was in your blood.
I think so.
Yeah.
Something about it. You know, and I was... in my early 20s, I played flute. I had a bass clarinet, and friends would come over, and we'd have these like free form jams. I think we played some jazz heads, but it was a lot of just improvisation, just free form, and really outside stuff. And I lived in an apartment building. Nobody ever complained. One night, somebody brought over some congas, and I started playing them, and I wouldn't get off them. I didn't want to play the woodwinds. I just was so having so much fun. It was such a direct communication with that instrument, unlike the wind instruments. It was the only time that the neighbors complained.
Okay. Well, that's never happened to me.
Yeah, right.
Just kidding. So who was your main teacher early on?
Well,
it was Kim, I guess.
Kim for a couple of years, and he really gave me a strong foundation. He was a student of C.K. Lakzekpo's, and... C.K. is an African master drummer from Ghana.
Okay.
And C.K. was the first person to really explain the structure correctly of African rhythm. So I always, for years, I thought everybody had the same foundation as I did. But I was very fortunate to have learned C.K.'s principles through Kim.
Which are what? How would you... Describe
well,
that.
These rhythms are generated through cross rhythm, like three beats over two beats in the same amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
you know, going back to the earliest transcriptions in the field of ethnomusicology, there's been a lot of misunderstanding about the structure of African rhythm, sub-Saharan African rhythm. Mm-hmm. Some of the early charts have different parts written in different time signatures. 6-4, okay. 3-4, even the standard 12 bell, the earliest transcriptions had it in two measures, one of 5-8, excuse me, and one of 5-8 and 7-8.
Wow.
So yeah.
Yeah.
And that comes,
did it still work out kind of like the same sound?
Well, it's the same it's the same pattern of attack points but completely okay. out of context.
Okay. Yeah.
And that's because a couple of reasons. One was ethnomusicology first investigated Asian music, which is additive. You add 5 plus 7,
yeah.
you know, that kind of formula as yeah. opposed to divisive rhythm. Which yeah. is African rhythm, where you divide the musical period of time into even sections. And it's also misinterpreting accent as meter. In other words,
got
if the
it.
Bell
sure.
is accenting, that's where the time is. Well, no, the bell is playing counter to the meter.
Yeah.
That's the
yeah.
whole point.
Yeah, they just weren't getting polyrhythm, I guess.
Not at all.
No. And we'll obviously be talking about that.
That's right.
But first of all, so like we're kind of... the idea in this podcast is to kind of start out with history, you know, and what got you where you are, you know, and what got you into this mode of being, let's just call you Dr. Clave. Mm-hmm. So your main teacher, Marcus Gordon.
Yeah, Marcus Gordon for many years.
Yeah.
Marcus was part of a group of young drummers in New York City in the early 60s that learned how to decipher rhythms off of records. Like bata rhythms and rumba, and when he told me this, the story of how he would do this, I was amazed that somebody could actually pick that stuff off of records because I just couldn't hear it.
Yeah.
was, you know, the effect of the accumulated parts was what I was hearing, but the fact that somebody could do this inspired me to work towards that goal.
Yeah.
But which I eventually was able to do,
mm-hmm.
and then my vast record collection became this vast lesson library of lessons,
yeah,
and that started me on years of deciphering recordings, and also going to see live recording performances rather,
mm-hmm.
because that's of course there's so much you get from seeing the music in its context.
Oh, no doubt, yeah,
you know. But Marcus was not, unlike Kim, was very intellectual and gave me that structure. Marcus was not intellectual so much, and that was a good balance.
Yeah,
he had a lot of so much of what he gave me was feel.
Okay.
And
well, speaking of which, you want to talk yeah. a minute about like we actually talked a bit before we started here, and you were saying like the old hippie days and you know, living out in the forest and how. Basically, you considered yourself an anti-intellectual, you know, and most of us, like especially at Conga Place and here at the camp, and most of us think of you as Dr. Clave, you know, the guy that's just really intellectual.
Yes, I know. And but when I got into this music, Afro-Cuban and African-related music, I had struggled with reading music as a flute player, never was a strong reader in marching band. You know, I'd be marching along playing the flute, and I would hear, I'd have the little chart in front of me, but I would hear the other flutes play the melody, and by the third time, I just got it from ear.
Yeah,
I was always
memorizing. Yeah.
Yeah, I was always much stronger with my ear. And I was just so relieved to play music that wasn't written down, that I learned by rote.
Mm-hmm.
And there was also a sense of... a while back for me that analyzing the music was somehow like disrespectful or was so out of the cultural context of the music that it shouldn't be done. But I just, you know, really what it was I just didn't want to think of the music like that anymore. I found a way to play music that suited my sensibility.
Yeah.
And I was very happy to finally do that because I always wanted to play music.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. And you're like, here I am playing congas. Woohoo. Yeah.
And I just kept playing and playing. And I was fortunate to play with, have a group of friends to play with regularly and who were pretty obsessed as well.
Right.
And I advanced through just doing it.
So who were some of those friends? Are they some of the teachers here?
Well, one of my early friends is Philip Ross, who now owns Boogaloo Productions, has some of the best.
Oh, cool. And I love that company.
Yeah, yeah, great stuff. Great videos of Cuban music and dance.
Yeah.
And we were students of Kim's.
Okay.
And when I moved up to Humboldt County, I found out that people wanted to learn how to play this kind of music. And so I fell into a teaching role.
Yeah.
And so I had to teach people in order to be able to play with people. And it wasn't too long. There was some sharp folks that started getting good enough to play with me. And I didn't set out to be a teacher, but I fell into it. And I think I got pretty comfortable with it. But again, I wasn't, you know, I would organize, I had a ways of organizing the music and presenting it, but I wasn't what you'd call a Dr. Clobby at that point, you know.
You had some weak areas.
as much as we could intuit it, that's the way to go. That was my approach.
Right.
You know, okay. Learn by rote, not so much explanation and certainly not that much analysis.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds like this. Okay. Dun.
Yeah, you do this and I do that and
yeah,
here we go.
Yeah, all right. Well, you know, then you were here at, you know, teaching at this camp. And so last year, my fourth year here, I took the Abiqua class from you, which was really awesome, by the way. It was like a mind expander as far as the lead part, the
bongo. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just remember that being so awesome. So, and you were pointing to your book and it's like, oh my God, he wrote this huge book, you know, and it's this giant book called Clave Matrix. And one of the first things that you said, you know, to the class was, check the cover out. It's threes and twos, you know, and it's like this little, it looked like just a tapestry or a basket weave on there,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And you said you like made that up, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's based on a carved, a design that's carved on a Ghanaian drum.
Okay.
And I was looking for some kind of a carving or design, African design, that represented the rhythm, at least in some way, suggested the rhythmic structure. And that really, really did it. But then I developed it further for the cover, and I created a grid,
and then repeated it somehow. Like you got,
yeah.
To use like a computer
for infinity. And... Yeah, yeah. Now, I actually hired somebody, a designer, to do it. I would do sketches on graph paper, and then he would render them.
Gotcha. Okay.
But then he would get lost in the tapestry. But I'd have to come over to his house and say, no.
Yeah, that was that. Wrong. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It was a lot of fun. The
colors repeat in threes and twos as
exactly.
Well as the pattern itself.
And I originally I had a more complex design color
yeah.
scheme.
Uh-huh.
But that just assaulted the senses. It was just too much. And so after some experimenting, I came up with this design, which I feel really good about. You know, the brain, our brains are attracted to designs that have a certain amount of simplicity or structure that we can grasp,
yeah.
yet some kind of complexity that intrigues us.
Yeah.
Right? So
yep.
So I really struggled with that. I'm happy with what I came up with. And the explanation of this design is, you see that there's three horizontal rectangles,
uh-huh.
and there's two vertical rectangles.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So that's the three and the two.
Right.
Now, three over two or three against two is the most basic cross-rhythmic cell from which all this music is generated.
Yeah.
So
so a cell being
the most simplest form, you know, of the rhythm.
Isn't it not the thing that keeps repeating over time?
It's repeated. Yeah, it's repeated. Yeah. Yeah, okay. That's how it's generally used. I use the term cell to be specifically something that cycles every two main beats. But I use it that way because I had to use terminology for things. I had to come up with terminology for things that haven't been described yet.
Uh-huh.
So in doing that, I tried as hard as I could to use terminology that already is in use and has a similar meaning. So I didn't, I don't want to come up with any more new words than I absolutely have to.
Uh-huh. So should we tap out, like, for whoever's in the audience listening, maybe what a 2/3 sounds like?
Yeah, no, we'll just listen to the track.
Have something to just go on there.
Yeah, this is all in the...
So you're probably listening to this now. We're not listening to it. We're recording this, but we're going to put it in the background.
Yeah, okay. So check out, there's the 3 in 1 channel and the 2 in the other channel.
Ooh, okay.
Now, I took this 3-against-2 motif, I developed it further by putting a color scheme into it.
Yeah, right.
And so the 3 vertical sections are an alternating color scheme of 2, because you'll see that...
You mean the horizontal ones?
I'm sorry. Yeah, the horizontal ones are, the 3 horizontals are alternate every other section of 3. The first one is white, red, white.
Yeah.
The second is red, white, red, and then it keeps alternating.
Yeah.
The 2 vertical sections are in a color scheme of 3.
So, oh, because it's either red, white, or white, red, or red, red.
Exactly.
Or,
no, then it can
but
be
there's
peace.
No white, white.
Right.
Okay. So it's 3.
So the sections of 2 are in a color scheme of 3.
Yeah.
And the sections of 3 are in a color scheme of 2. And what that does.
Brilliant.
Oh, thank you.
Absolutely brilliant.
I'm very happy with that.
Yeah.
What that does is it creates cross rhythm. You actually see, if you stand back from the design, you can see diagonal red lines crossing the page.
That's right, yeah. And that's a cross rhythm.
That's a visual representation of cross rhythm. Now, if we use the box notation, we could create the same thing. You'd see the X's in the boxes going at a diagonal.
Right, right.
And that's actually something I want to... That's a project that I have that I need to finish is showing cross rhythm in these kinds of designs in box notation and then in standard notation.
Yeah.
Because when you see the beats diagonally crossing, the term cross rhythm.
That's kind of what it means. Yeah.
That's what it means. Yeah.
I've seen those before and I've noticed them. And I never really thought that was a cross rhythm. I saw it crossing, but never really. Put 2 and 2 together. That's cool. You were mentioning earlier, I think we were talking before this, that something about the genesis of clave.
Mm-hmm.
I was curious what you meant by genesis of clave. You also talked about the unified theory of clave, like what is it that unifies it? What do you mean by that?
Well, there's a generating principle. All this music, all this sub-Saharan African music and its descendants in the New World, the diaspora music, it's generated from cross rhythm. And the formula is this. There's triple subdivisions of the main beats and duple subdivisions of the main beat. In African rhythm, triple and duple function as opposites. So a sub-Saharan African rhythm is generated by grouping triple pulses in duple groupings and triple groupings of duple pulses. In other words, you group the pulses in their opposite. Now, just saying that, just stating the generating principle of this music immediately induces like a type of dyslexia.
Yeah,
right?
It's like, where does that go? Yeah.
Right? Duple groupings of triple pulses and triple groupings of duple pulses. But that's what's going on. And that is also that kind of dyslexia by just contemplating what I just said, that's the effect of the music.
Uh-huh.
That's what's going on when you're
it gets
kind
you
of
a little
spinning.
Bit confused and spun out.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. It's very attractive. It has uh-huh. it has the same kind of, you know, allure, like say this design, in fact more, of course, you know.
It's like a fire and we're all moths and we're going to go up close and get burned mm-hmm. by it. Yeah.
Although it does invoke strong emotions too, as you I'm sure know, there's yeah. a lot of people that don't care for this music.
True.
Right?
So yeah. I hate that. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of folks aren't neutral about this kind of music. They mm-hmm. have either strongly like or dislike it.
Yeah.
Because that's a very strong effect, but that is the generating principle. Okay. And it generates clave and all the other structures.
So, for example, clave is?
Clave is 3 against 2 is 1/2, the first
mm-hmm,
half.
Mm-hmm.
The second half is a displaced 3 against 2.
Yeah, okay. So, I of course, get this, but I just wanted you to make sure you got that out.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, all right. And so you were saying earlier also that Islam was kind of the glue that brought this music through all the different places it went or something?
Well, we were talking specifically about the rhythmic figure that the Cubans call tresillo.
That's right. Yeah,
which
yeah,
is
yeah.
this.
Uh-huh.
And it's a rhythm that you find in this vast geographic belt stretching from Morocco in West Africa to Southeast Asia. In all these different types of music, it appears. And what I was saying is that I hypothesize mm-hmm. that it spread east through the spread of Islam.
Okay.
Because that's the only unifying element in that whole geographic belt.
Okay.
And as you go north out of that area, that you don't find it. But each culture interprets that figure in a different way. They generate it differently.
Because so it may not mean the same thing. Tresillo for like playing Mas Moody or whatever on your Doomback is different than someone else's.
Yeah, it's kind of like what you do with it is different.
Mm-hmm.
But it's such a, I think it has a certain appeal, you know, that is easily adaptable into all types of music. As a matter of fact, going back to the birth of jazz at the turn of the 20th century, the first non-on-the-beat marching bass drum pattern
yeah.
is basically based on tresillo. So that's the beginning of jazz syncopation. It's also the kick bass of hip-hop music is often tresillo, and you hear it now superimposed in Southeast Asian club music, African club music, Caribbean club music, European, North American.
Basically everywhere. Yeah.
Basically everywhere. It's a very, it works in a lot of settings, but I believe it came from Sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah, and so we were just talking about tresillo, but
yeah.
then, you know, and there are, of course, elements of tresillo in clave, so...
It's the first half of clave.
Okay to bring that up, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, David, you made a CD a couple of years ago then?
I always had I always loved those rare recordings of African percussion where there wasn't any singing on it. Now, eventually I got into singing and learning Orisha songs. That was several years of study.
Yeah.
And I, you know, really enjoyed that. But just having tracks where there's just percussion, I always had appreciation for that. There's not that many of them. There's one record Tito Puente did called In Percussion, where it's him, Mongo Santa Maria, Patato, Willie Bobo, all playing drums and just improvising.
Mm-hmm.
And so that inspired me to do... to produce a record for Bembe Records that was just percussion with no singing. And I wanted just to feature the orchestra of percussion. We also have like a marimbula, which is a a giant lamellophone, like a giant kalimba,
playing
the bass line, and we added some other things in there just to kind of tonally...
To give it some melody.
Yeah, some melody and kind of expand the sound a little bit. And the way the record was created is we had one day, basically, the Cuban instructors at the workshop had a day off. I hired them to bring them in the studio and told them what I wanted to do. They were hesitant at first because they of course, told me, we depend on the singing for inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm asking them to do something rather abstract and kind of strange. But they actually got into it after a while.
Yeah.
and we just let the tape roll, and then later I came and edited it, you know.
Yeah.
One thing I did with Howard Kaufman and Eugene Novotny, though, later, was we overtracked different bird whistles. Howie has this great collection of bird whistles, and each bird is playing a specific 12-8 rhythm, like a drum part, you know, or clave.
Mm-hmm.
And because we multi-tracked it, the effect of listening to the recording is like walking through a jungle where as you're walking, the sound of one bird is coming closer, and then as you pass under, it starts going behind you. And for most folks listening to that particular cut, it just sounds like being in a jungle, which is fine with the birds, different birds and animals going. But if you listen to the rhythm that the birds are singing, you realize that everything is in time. Everything is in, you know, like 12-8 clave structure. So I just had a lot of fun doing that. And I actually would like to do more of that. When I take a break from writing music, I want to get into some more of that stuff, because that's just a real...
It sounds fun.
Way fun, and really cool effects from that.
Yeah, neat. What was the other thing?
oh,
Bembe Records.
Well, yeah. You know, Jimmy Derschlag is my partner, and we started Bembe Records in 1994. And we saw a lot of record companies specializing in Cuban music come and go, you know, and distributors have gone out of business. It's really rough for the record industry is practically non-existent, but we're still selling. We're doing a lot of online downloads. That's the new wave.
I'm sure that's where you get all your money now. Yeah,
most of it. Yeah, and we wanted to be we wanted to specialize in what we call progressive Afro-Cuban music that had a commercial appeal but had a certain amount of creativity involved. And the three areas we focus on our Afro-Cuban folkloric, dance music like salsa or timba, and jazz.
Okay.
But a lot of the music we put out has at least two of those elements at the same time.
Okay.
Our CD Baba Luaye by Irakere was actually nominated for a Grammy.
Nice.
And that was it was so cool. I was living way out in the woods. I finally had a phone because I had to do business. I got a call from, I think it was Forbes magazine, saying, "How do you feel about being nominated for a Grammy?" I was like, "What?
What? Yeah."
That was really exciting. In 1997, I went to Cuba to take a 2-week salsa dance course, or a dance course in Cuban popular music. And I had been thinking for 20 years I was learning how to dance salsa. And when I hit 40, I realized, you know, if I don't learn this now, I'm never going
to do it.
I'm just kidding myself. So I figured a 2-week dance course, every day we're dancing.
And that was in Cuba?
That was in Cuba, in Havana, at the National School of the Arts.
Wow.
Every student had a professional Cuban dancer as a partner.
Wow.
So these women were making me lead them. You know what I mean? Made me feel like I was such a good dancer because they were professional. They knew exactly.
They could sort of pull you a little bit.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, I need to go that way.
Yeah. It was like, look what I'm doing. And of course, they were helping, but it was an amazing experience. And that's when I got to see all these timba bands live. The music there doesn't start till midnight.
Okay.
And ends at 4. Classes at 8 o'clock in the morning. And then,
oh my God.
Yeah. And in the afternoon,
sleep.
Well, no, I conducted business for Bembay. So I was out seeing the record executives, artists, managers.
Yeah.
I had a translator and a driver, which was quite amazing. There were special activities in the afternoon that the course offered, but I didn't do those. I would take the dance classes, have lunch, and then we would go out into Havana and I would conduct business.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that...
that you're still alive.
I know. You know what it was? I was so pumped full of adrenaline. The whole thing was such a thrill that I actually functioned for 2 weeks just fine doing that.
Yeah.
But,
nice. Yeah.
But the Egram Studios, that's the... Egram is the Cuban state-run record company.
And
in their headquarters in Havana, they've got the archives. They've got recordings going
all the way back
all
to
the way
day
back.
One. Huh?
Yeah. And so I was a kid in a candy store. You know, I'm a record collector.
Okay.
And so
could you buy any of them? Or
well,
how did you
it's
bring
better
them?
Than that.
Yeah.
Because I was a record executive, I would request certain types of music, and the engineer would bring me the reel to reel, hook it up, the master tape, and play it. And I'd go, oh yeah, please. And they would please put that on cassette for me. And then I'd say, no, I'm looking for something like this. And they go, okay, cool. And you come back with something else. And anyway, after spending half the day there, the engineer had a long list of things to transfer to cassette. And I took all these cassettes home for Jimmy and I to consider to license from Egram. But that was that was just a very memorable experience, being in the actual studio and having access to all the recordings. And I could have spent weeks there listening to things.
It's like the ultimate source.
The ultimate source.
Yeah, it's like finding the source of the Nile.
Exactly. it really was like that. And we one of the results was we reissued a record by Generoso Jimenez, the great trombone player, who was a musical director for Benny Murray. He did a great record that's, you know, was out of print and unheard of, and that was just a great experience. It's ironic that to me that I ended up being such a geeky theorist, because I never thought that's what I would do with this. You know, this started out as a very emotional, sensual kind of pursuit. But my dad has 2 PhDs, and he's a professor, and he writes books and edits books. And so it's been really interesting that I turned into my dad, kind of.
Yeah. It's scary, isn't it?
Well, it's great. It's given us an opportunity to connect. And he really helped me with a lot of the formatting of the Clave Matrix. I actually bought the Chicago Manual of Style and learned about where to put the periods in the commas, and it's surprisingly, I actually found that interesting. It's
you are a chip off of the old block, then. So and that kind of brings us to the second book, you know, the Quinto book, and I think, you know, you had something to say about like why it was that and not like maybe your original idea of continuing into sort of the geek realm of.
Yeah.
Stuff.
Well, initially I thought that I was going to write the series so that the first books would be foundational and they would get more and more complex, and the last books would be, well, the series would culminate in lead drum parts and improvising in piano, you know, non-percussion instruments like that. So it's first I would do the foundation and then end up with the aspect of improvising.
Okay.
But after finishing the Clave Matrix, and these volumes have been in various stages of development for the last 16 years. You know, I've been with my editor, Peter Greenwood, we've been working on it for years and years and doing drafts over and over again. And anyway, after I finally got the first book out, I realized that I needed to do something different.
Yeah.
And the Clave Matrix is it can be read cover to cover, but it's I see a lot of people using it as a reference book. And they get a question about the theory or some structural issues. So I wanted to write a book that would be purely an instruction book. And also, a kind of what I said before was the Clavier Matrix is kind of like your well-balanced vegetable meal. The Rumba Quinto is the dessert.
Yeah.
Because it's hundreds
of... Now let's have some fun.
Let's have some fun. Hundreds of quinto licks. That's the kind of thing I know that drummers are looking for. You know, the hot licks.
True.
And, of course, you know, it's very structured. It's methodical as... You know, uh-huh. Because that's where I'm at now.
Yeah.
But I wanted to write something like that. And also write something that would suggest I'm a player, not just a theorist. Because like you were alluding to, I have a reputation currently of being a...
Just a big high nerd, right?
A total nerd. I mean, the biggest clavier nerd you will ever encounter.
But Dave is actually an amazing player.
Well, thanks.
Yeah, I've witnessed it, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I spent my time doing. I find myself writing about music and thinking about music more than I play now, but it's all about playing. I mean,
yeah, and that's why, obviously. I mean, that's why you nerd out on it, because you love it, right? Yeah. So we get the book from Benbay.com?
Benbay.com, Amazon.
Okay.
Boogaloo.
Okay. So four different spots. Yeah, yeah, okay. All right. Thank you, Dave.
You're welcome.
This has been a fun interview. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.